I'm ready.
Call the Senate Committee on Health and Human Services to order this morning. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 303. It's called Gary Weeks and Charlotte Duncan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members of the committee. I'm Gary Weeks, Director of the Department of Human Resources. I'm here to talk with you about Senate Bill 303. This is the second hearing we've had on Senate Bill 303, and just to refresh the committee's memory a bit, there are three key parts of Senate Bill 303. First is the change in the name of the department from the Department of Human Resources to the Department of Human Services. That name change is effective July 1 of the year 2000. The reason for deferral is to make it possible for us to have the change in the department's name without having any fiscal impact. In other words, we use up all of our business cards and letterhead and materials and make this change without a fiscal impact to the agency's budget. The second point in the legislation is one that gives the director the ability to organize the department in the manner necessary to conduct the work of the department. And you recall that the AG had said to us in advice that the director has the ability to change existing parts of the agency, but doesn't have any ability to change any new parts of the agency, so we could adjust current divisions but not create new divisions on your work groups and so on like that. The third piece in this bill is it gives the director the same authority as the divisions have, which I think is eminently reasonable, and allows the director to delegate his or her authority to other parts of the agency as necessary to do business. Now, in the first hearing that we had on this, one advocacy group came forward and expressed some concerns about the possibility that the bill would limit in some way input from advocacy groups, and that there could be some impact on federal funding and federal relationships. So, since that hearing over the past 2 weeks plus, we've met with many advocacy organizations and had a lot of conversations with the federal, Mr. Chairman, with the federal government. You now have before you letters from almost all the groups we met, including the Healthcare Association, which is made up of the nursing homes and other long-term care facilities, the Oregon Rehabilitation Association. We have a letter from the Governor's Commission on Seniors, as well as the United Seniors of Oregon. We have a letter from the Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities from Gene Oregon, also with the Disabilities Commission. And Charlotte Duncan, to my left, is with the Disabilities Council. And as you'll see from the comments in all those letters, we believe that the three amendments that I'll go through with you in just a moment satisfy the concerns that were expressed in the earlier meeting. I mentioned to you we also have had conversations with regional office in Seattle that manages the DRG programs. The federal concerns on this legislation centered on the legislature's need to approve any change in the organization of the department and that no action be taken by the department that is not consistent with federal law. And I think we've addressed both of those in the proposed amendments. We've also been advised that there is no language in the bill that jeopardizes, at this point in time, any federal funding. So let me, if I may, Mr. Chairman, take you through the proposed amendments. There are three that are pretty direct and pretty simple. They all begin on page 3 of the bill. On page 3, line 11, the amendments that we're offering to you delete the clause, notwithstanding any other provision of law. We've deleted that in part because of federal concerns that we would do something in state law that would cause us to violate federal law, although I don't think that's legally possible. But many people were more comfortable with us striking this language. Frankly, your own legislative council has never liked the phrase notwithstanding any other law, so this is a pretty easy change for us to make. On line 13, talking about the same statement, line 13, we have added language after the word department, which says, consistent with federal requirements and after consultation with parties affected by such change, including but not limited to service providers, advisory committees, and county government. So the whole statement beginning on line 11 says that the department may organize or reorganize the department in a manner the director considers necessary to properly conduct the work of the department, consistent with federal requirements, and after consultation with parties affected by such changes, including but not limited to service providers, advisory committees, and county government. So the revised statement has the effect of saying you can, Mr. Director or Ms. Director, you may organize the department in any way you want, but before doing that, you've got to make sure that it's consistent with federal law, you're not breaking any federal law, and that you have consulted with all parties that would be affected by the change that's being proposed. The next change that we have is in line 16, still on page 3. In line 16, we're deleting the new language that was in the bill, which said that the director shall report the transfer of any monies to the Legislative Assembly in reinserting that the transfer must first be approved by the legislature. So we're coming back to existing law. Existing law says that any time the director wants to transfer limitations or appropriations, he or she must come before either the emergency board or the legislature. I'm comfortable with that. My original proposal to you was that we would do it and report to the legislature. Others are not so comfortable with that, so we've gone back to the original language. The third and final change is on page 3 also, on line 21, where once again we have struck language that says, notwithstanding any other provisional law, and inserted consistent with federal requirements. So now we have in three places on this one page said that we would not do anything that is inconsistent with federal law or federal requirements. Those amendments are the ones that we have reached agreement with all the parties that I've described for you earlier and are confirmed by the letters before you. Again, they're amendments that I'm comfortable with. I think we have a good bill here, and I would urge you to move this bill forward with the amendments I described to you. I'd be pleased to answer your questions, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, this would require actually incorporating all three, the dash 1, dash 2, and dash 3 amendments.
Mr. Chairman, Palafoe tells me that dash 1s and 2s are in rolled up in the dash 3s. So the dash 3 amendments cover everything I just described to you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I will be supportive of these amendments just because you've gone to a lot of work and gotten people to agree. But I frankly think that the second amendment, where you have to come back to ways and means, ways back to e-board constantly, is a real nuisance. I mean, for the e-board and for you. I wish we weren't doing that. But maybe that's the only way you were able to get support for the whole thing. I mean, I think you have to have, I think managers have to have the ability to move things around within the limits of the law. And obviously you can't move something, you can't intermingle federal and other funds and so forth like that. And it looked to me as the original one was a good management tool. And my complaint all the time, we talk about managing government like you would your business or your home, and then you put certain constraints like this that make it even more difficult. I wish we didn't have to do that. Is that something that has to be done to get an agreement?
We went over this very thoroughly to my extent.
Yeah.
And for reasons the fiscal that seems pretty necessary to get this way.
Well, I'm not going to fight it, but I just wanted to put that.
Mr. Chairman, on the record, I really appreciate what you're saying. That was my intent in putting it in here in the first place, was because I thought, as you do, the director ought to be able to manage it. But as the chair has pointed out, there are some reservations on the part of fiscal with this kind of language. There are reservations on the part of some of the advocacy groups that are here. And you know, we've managed to make it so far by coming back to the emergency board and the legislature anytime a major change is necessary. And for all practical purposes, I can't imagine any director making a major change in the way money spent without first coming before you and saying, here's my intent, this is why I think it ought to happen, and proceeding that way.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think just a reminder to us is that, you know, we keep hearing about these agencies running back and forth to the e-board. Well, we put constraints that force them to do that, and that's why I kind of hate to see that story. Because I know they hate to go to e-board. I mean, it isn't exactly a fun thing to have to do.
Well, I wouldn't say I hate to go to e-board with all that.
I understand.
It's a necessary part of the process.
Just, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator
Castillo. Just for the record, I'd just like to echo the comments that Senator Duncan just made on this part of the amendment before us. And I think it is getting into a little bit of micromanaging, and I think it, I was comfortable with the other language, but I'll be supportive of this since I know it's part of the negotiations that brought you back to us today. So, thank you.
Go ahead and start.
Chair Fisher and members of the committee, I'm Charlotte Duncan. I'm the director of the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Council, and we're here today in support of the Senate Bill 303 with the proposed amendments. We believe the structure of the bureaucracy must reflect the needs of its customers, and we believe in order to do that, periodic review of the structure within the organization bureaucracy needs to be reviewed. There are a number of new strategies and philosophies and methodologies over the past few years that have challenged us a lot at the local level to be responsive and reflective to things like family support and individual empowerment, return to work and self-determination, work incentives, all of those changes, some of which come down from Congress and some of which we are insightful enough in Oregon to see that we need to make some changes to serve our customers better. During the past biennium, we have observed some of the challenges presented by the current structure in moving to empowerment and independence for people with disabilities and their families, and we believe that Senate Bill 303 can promote greater uniformity and authority throughout the department. There, we have observed that there is inconsistency between the divisions within the department in terms of being having the authority to be more directly involved with families and individuals. And we think that this offers an opportunity to look at eliminating some of those current barriers and possibly promoting greater service efficiency, or hopefully promoting greater service efficiency. Across the country, we're seeing a trend in moving toward generic services, and we do have some concerns about people with disabilities. We feel that generic service systems need to become more responsive to people with disabilities in order to be able to serve them, and that there are valid reasons that some aspects of specialized services must be maintained. Failure to have a meaningful process prior to reorganization could lead to a result of poor service rather than improved service. We support the proposed amendments. We don't believe that any director of the department should have unlimited authority to make change without some legislative approval and oversight. We believe it is critical that before any significant changes, mergers, or consolidations occur, that there be meaningful conversations with all of the parties that would include those that Gary mentioned in his amendments, the divisions within DHR, the local government, consumers, providers, and others that are engaged in partnerships with the department. We believe Senate Bill 303 can provide a balance in both the flexibility and restraints that are needed to achieve the best possible service and move to some of the system changes that we are currently experiencing that we believe leads to more positive and productive lives for people with disabilities, for Oregonians with disabilities. Thank you for the opportunity of support, and I'd be happy to answer any questions or provide you with any examples.
Thank you. Angela Ellerby, would you comment? I believe you're in agreement with these, but I want it on record. Thank you for your concern.
Thank you, Senator Fisher. I'm a member to the committee. My name is Angela Hillaby. I'm chair of the State Rehabilitation Council, advising the Vocational Rehabilitation Department. We were the people who brought up concerns of Senate Bill 303, and we have worked with Gary and his designee to come up with sufficient wording in the interim. This morning, your committee administrator gave me the latest draft amendment. I can say that this goes a long way to addressing our concerns. Since our full legislative committee hasn't had a chance to see the new amendments, I cannot speak with unanimity, but I do believe this will address all of our concerns. And if it doesn't, we'll get back with him. Gary has done a great deal toward working with us and making this work. Are there any questions?
Do you feel that the Dash 3 amendments incorporate all of them?
They definitely address our major concerns, which were providing an opportunity for advocates to give their input on major changes to the department and making sure things stay in consistency with federal requirements so that federal funding is not jeopardized. Not being a lawyer, I don't know whether this would be 100% adequate, but it looks good.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yes, Senator Shannon.
We received some concerns from the Federation for the Blind. Does that mean that they do not oppose this bill anymore, do you think, with this amendment?
I have not been in contact with Federation for the Blind, and I don't know what their concerns are. Can you detail what the concerns are?
Well, they just asked us to oppose it.
Okay.
But there was no date on the letter.
They have not been in contact with me, so I don't know what their concerns are.
I have letters here that I want to enter for the record or put together for the committee's benefit here. Oregon Healthcare Association is in favor of the amended version. Oregon Rehabilitation Association, Governor's Commission on Senior Services, United Seniors of Oregon, Oregon State Council of Senior Citizens, Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, and a letter from Eugene, Oregon. I think Eugene has enough knowledge of the issues of sight disabilities that would pretty well take care of the concerns of that group.
Okay.
And I believe it would also myself.
Okay.
Yes, Senator Duncan.
Sure. We have a question up here. It says ask about IL.
That'll be later, independent living.
Okay. All right. Well, the frustration was getting to me up here. I just need to know. Thank you.
Monday morning.
Are you we're in the working session? Sure. I move the Dash 3 amendment. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Senator Duncan moves the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 303. Further discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so order.
Chair, I move 303 as amended to 204 with a due pass recommendation.
I'm going to hold that for one second.
Okay.
I want to make sure that the Dash 3s are inclusive on one and 2. Senator Duncan has moved that we move Senate Bill 303 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Further discussion? Objection? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Duncan said he would carry the bill, so I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 303 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 610. Thank you. Jim Crawl, Mike McCracken, and Jack Morgan. I encourage you to make your statements as brief as possible. It seems like the last week here we're going to be having quite a few things to get done here. Any facilitation of time will be appreciated.
Thank you, Chair Fisher, members of the committee. My name is Tim Crawl, and I'm director of the Oregon Rehabilitation Association. We represent nonprofit providers of community services throughout the state. This bill would help us with a very serious problem, and that is that often after contract agreements are made and amendments are made, it takes months and months for providers to get their money after they have begun providing the service. For example, last session, the critical staff salary increases that the legislature approved and all of this committee approved took providers had to front the money to their staff to keep up with the timelines that were published, even though the money didn't arrive to them for many months. Senator Shannon has gratefully agreed to introduce this bill to help us streamline this process and perhaps eliminate the slow review process by the Attorney General. And I believe you're well aware of the problem, and I will conclude with that. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michael Packen. I'm representing the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. Those are county mental health departments across the state. We're certainly aware of the problems that Mr. Crowell has briefly outlined. For the past 5 or 6 weeks now, we've been in rather intensive meetings with the Attorney General's office and with the Mental Health Division and with providers. Not at this point ready to cast blame for the problem, other than just to point out that there are a huge number of changes that have to be reviewed, and because of legislation passed last session, many of these require the review and approval of the Attorney General's office. There are over 60,000 lines of changes that occur in those multiples of contracts between counties and providers. And we certainly don't want to be in a position where providers are absorbing losses of dollars because we can't get contracts approved in a timely fashion. And worse yet, we don't want to delay the movement of people, fragile people, who need to have a better facility available for them. I feel very positive now about the negotiations that are going on with the Attorney General, and I feel that we're within a couple of weeks of reaching closure. There is a problem that part of the solution is connected to a bill that seems to have died on the Senate floor last week, Senate Bill 389, and that would have allowed for some retroactivity so that a contract could go into effect upon the date of agreement rather than the date all the contract copies are signed. I know that the bill is up for reconsideration, so there's a possibility that it will be part of the solution. If not, we may need to add this bill some provisions that would help us to get through this sort of huge logjam of contract changes and developments.
Have you looked at the DAC amendment?
Oh, yeah, those are fine.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jack Morgan. I'm with the Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division. We agree with both the counties and the providers that this is a very significant problem. It's one that we've been trying to address for a number of years. The bill itself, the department of justice had some concerns about the bill. In part, they were believing that we might be able to solve this problem without additional legislation. So we've looked at existing legislation, their exemption authority under that legislation, ways of restructuring the contract, and so on to address this problem. We've also been working with the counties, including a group of county councils who get together routinely with the Department of Justice to review improvements in contracts. We're hopeful that we'll be able to resolve this in the next 2 weeks. We're unclear at this point whether provisions will legislative provisions will be needed to implement the changes that we're proposing or not. So, with your permission, we would like to continue our work with the counties and providers, Department of Justice, and come back to you.
Okay. Are you telling me then that you want me to hold on this?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Okay, give me a timeline.
2 weeks.
Okay, pushing it there.
How about by the 30th?
Yes. All right, any questions? Observations then? Hearing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 610. I'll ask the administration to keep us posted to it.
Not a problem.
Should have maybe asked your permission to do
that. That's fine. We just need to solve the problem.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. It's your goal. What do you want to do? 11:30, 31 minutes. Thank you.
Do this thing?
That's partially the other day. So that's Senate Bill 22 we had the other day. He just bypassed it. They're a little different than 140 or 141, but that kind of wrapped up in some.
I know that Senator Duke said to go and vote on a bill in the stream.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 140. Senate Bill 1140. Simon Paquette, Margaret Carley, want to go right ahead.
Thank you. I'm addressing this morning in support of Senate Bill 1140 that represents a significant step forward in establishing the evidence needed to adequately care for Oregonians with pain. I provide supervision and clinical direction for the care of over 2,000 patients and their families in the Mid-Willamette Valley for hospice care from 1993 to 1997. The overwhelming problem I faced every day was the ineffective treatment of symptoms of pain experienced by patients with majority diagnosis for cancer, heart disease, COPD, diabetes, ALS, and others. The cancer patients were particularly vulnerable to intense experience of pain, but so were the cardiac patients. Most doctors are dedicated, caring, and compassionate persons. However, I had a doctor tell a nurse providing care to a cardiac patient that it was normal for that type of disease patient to die in pain. When the nurse did an effective job of advocating for adequate pain control, the doctor denied her request. I called the administrator of the health clinic and advised about the law on Oregonians having the right to adequate pain control. The administrator advised me that it was a difficult situation and that any attempt that would be made to talk to the doctor would have consequences. The doctor did eventually prescribe medication based on the nurse's recommendations. The patient died pain-free 4 days later, and we were thanked by the family. The doctor made it a point to call the nurse after the patient died and tell her that she was out of line and inappropriate to question his judgment. He further advised her that if she questioned his judgment again, that it would go badly for her. I made it clear to the same doctor that I would take action on her behalf to defend her should he do so. I was confident in my ethical resolve and rightness to stand behind a caring nurse in the face of a patient need. I was experienced a near 100% drop in referrals from that clinic and a significant hardship from the program I administered. Was there a relationship between the advocacy for effective pain control and the drop-off in referrals? It can never be proven, but there's no doubt in my mind. The doctor in question was also going to discharge a patient who was actively dying simply because he thought that keeping him in the hospital was inappropriate. It took the intervention of the clinic administrator and the medical director of a hospice to convince the same doctor that the hospital stay was paid for and okay with all concerns. The doctor I've described is not fictitious or a creation of several incidents. He is real and provides care. He's the same type of doctor that thinks that anyone who requests pain control medication is an addict and out to manipulate the system. I listened to a hospice medical director say that 9 out of 10 patients are drug seekers. I wondered how he drew that conclusion and how could he be so secure in his judgment. I also witnessed a drug-seeking client who ran up the cost of pain control for a hospice to the tune of $43,000 a month. She was effectively bankrupting a very effective program with her demands for control of pain. We established that her needs went beyond what was considered to be appropriate for the medical condition. We also established that her background showed all the indications of a possible dependency. But we did not have any data to go on. My medical director did a national search and came up with the experience of other programs saying 3 out of 1,000 could present the program with this problem. I was amazed at the incredible depth of ignorance we are all victim to when dealing with the pain of others. We do not know what it takes to treat all pain issues. We do not know how many persons suffer who do not need to because of our ignorance. We judge and assume all sorts of things that have no basis in fact. They are in fact the result of judgments of medical professionals who have no extensive formal training in psychosocial issues and limited training in how to treat pain effectively. Most medical schools are just now beginning to treat end-of-life pain issues as a serious ailment. Chronic pain is not even on the treatment map as a legitimate issue. Who cares about it anyway? My answer is that we all should, because any one of us could be the victim of intractable pain that is judged by those who do not have the data or training to understand our needs. Which one of us wants that experience? Who decided it was okay for anyone to be judged or suffer based on one person's decision? I treated the pain of over 2,000 patients and achieved 96% plus satisfied outcomes based on surveys. I also witnessed failures due to a lack of knowledge. We need to study and produce an effective knowledge base that will provide objective information for doctors to treat, learn, and grow as practitioners. We need to establish the kind of objective information to provide Oregonians with the tools to confront and educate their caregivers with symptoms that are not judged as drug-seeking, but rather as needs we can meet, treat, and provide effective care. Let us begin the process of gathering the information by passing Senate Bill 1140 and gathering objective information that eliminates myths, judgments, and poor care. Let us instead shed the light of knowledge on a problem that costs immense emotional, economic, and social costs. Help all those medical professionals who care for others in pain by studying pain objectively and set standards that allow Oregonians, doctors, nurses, and all others to meet needs objectively. Pain is not a condition of disease. It is a symptom of poor, inadequate, or ineffective treatment. Senate Bill 1140 is funded by the investment of foundations and grants from businesses that seek the knowledge we need to care for others. Oregon will gain knowledge at little cost and achieve better care for its citizens. Thank you.
Go ahead, Senator. I'll let Senator Dukes go ahead.
Oh, good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members.
Thank you for coming.
No, you're welcome. My three committees at one time is even a little beyond me, I'm afraid. Joan Duke, State Senator from District 1. We're doing 1140 now, right?
Yes.
Okay,
right.
I'm with you.
I won't try to do two at once. You got
Why not?
Already.
Senate Bill 1140 says, and I'm not sure if you've had the background, says that two demonstration projects, one urban, one rural, under OMAP. This piece, I think, is at the heart of a lot of present and future work that we've been trying to do on pain management. I will tell you up front, because this always matters to legislators, especially at this part of the session, there's no state funding involved in this bill. What we want to do is set up the two demonstration projects to work with patients under the Oregon Health Plan. And doctors will refer a patient who has been with them and experiencing pain that they've not been able to relieve for at least 3 months. The patient and the doctor will hook up with a team that will set up a pain assessment and set up a pain program, treatment plan, thank you, for this patient. And then the doctor will retain control of the patient and will manage the plan. It does two things. It relieves the patient's pain and it educates the physician. And as you just listened to Simon talking, there's a great need for physician education. I think we were before you what seems like yesterday was probably a few days ago with a bill where someone was asked, you know, what is the level of education of doctors? I think it was Senator Duncan saying, if I went to my doctor. And the answer is we don't know what kind of an answer you would get. It depends. Some doctors are very familiar with pain management, some somewhat familiar, some are not very familiar. So I think that the education is a good piece of this, but we want to demonstrate that pain management works, and we expect to also show you next session that it is less expensive than non-treatment of pain, that people have to go to the doctor fewer times, that they are better able to manage their lives. So some of the things that the Pain and Symptom Management Task Force wanted to achieve that felt they were unable to at this point in time, we hope to get at next session with the information that will come from this. And we have been assured that if we want to do things like establish pain as a diagnosis, that the information we will get from these demonstration projects is what we would have to have in order to be able to demonstrate that. So I mean, for two projects, at no cost to the state, we get a lot of good results, including we expect patients who will be able to have their pain managed and to live more productive lives.
Thank you. Go ahead, Margaret.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Margaret Murphy Carley. I'm the Legal Counsel, Deputy Director of Oregon Healthcare. I represent nursing homes, assisted living, and residential care facilities, and I served as Oregon Healthcare's representative on the Pain and Symptom Task Force. Oregon Healthcare supports Senate Bill 1140. It establishes a pain management demonstration project which would be administered by OMAP. The project would work with Oregon Health Plan clients who experience chronic pain. The funding is not state general revenue funds, but would come from private and foundation resources. We believe that timely and skillful management of the OHP patients in chronic pain will actually result in net savings to the Medicaid program. The study attempts to quantify these savings and to provide primary care physicians and their staff with the skills and information to manage persons in chronic pain. Many of the Oregon Health Plan clients reside in our members' nursing homes, assisted living, and residential care facilities, and we would believe that they would benefit from this research. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Colleague Janning and Dr. Phil Levesque. Dr. Levesque, maybe you could come on up and get things going.
Can I help
any? Oh, I'm trying to conserve as much time as we can here this morning. I noticed that you're in favor of this, so if you could make your comments as brief as possible.
Well, actually, I think I have some experience that's germane to this situation that needs to be heard. So I'm going to read my testimony because I think that would best give the input of what I feel about the issues before you now. Chair Fisher and members of the committee, my name is Ellie Jenny, and I'm here to ask for your support for these proposals. I believe that these proposals go a long way toward addressing the needs of Oregonians who live with pain. I have lived with pain for over 20 years and tend to think of myself as an expert in the arena of pain. Anything that will help folks in Oregon better live with their chronic pain is something I believe this committee needs to support. My coming and sitting here today is my way of supporting the cause of chronic pain. I think the Pain Task Force did a good job in researching pain. My only frustration is that there was no health plan consumer on the task force. Because of this, I believe the task force's findings do not represent the issues of folks living on rationed health care. The findings do not go far enough. They do not tell about how the Office of Medical Assistance Programs denies a powerful painkiller to folks on the health plan if they do not have cancer. Only folks with cancer can get a dose strong enough to kill their pain. the others are made to suffer. OMAP also won't pay for folks to go to a pain clinic to learn how to live with their pain. I would be dead right now without what I learned at a pain clinic. Pain clinics may not work for everyone, but they do work for some of us. Why is it that the state will pay for folks to kill themselves and yet not pay for things that would make life a little more livable? I think having an office at the DHR is a good idea. I imagine DHR has the resources to create an effective and complete outreach to help Oregonians who live in pain. I also think that having a demonstration project going on in Oregon will help in understanding and treating chronic pain. These proposals will be helpful for folks who live with pain. Pain has been with us for a long time, and I don't think any of us are immune to the problems that pain will cause in a lifetime. And I would just like to ask you guys to support anything that the task force for pain puts before you. I think it's a good beginning, but like I said, there's still issues.
Okay. Sure. Yes, I just say I like your sign, and I understand it well. You are good proof of it.
Oh,
yes. Dr. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Philip Levesque. I live in Malala. I practice medicine there, but I was also a medical school professor in pharmacology for over 30 years. I represent the State Legislative Committee of AARP, which, as you know, is about 400,000 people in Oregon. Many of them are subject to chronic pain, and when they go to a doctor, they're told either it's all in your head, or it's part of old age and get used to it, or you are a drug seeker. None of those, to me, have any pertinence whatsoever. I studied under Dr. Norman David at the University of Oregon Medical School and Dr. Hugo Kruger at Oregon State College, who are both world authorities on the use of opiates for the treatment of pain. Dr. Norman David said, regarding the use of opiates, whatever it takes. And one time when a student asked him, how much should you give, Dr. David looked at him and said, how hard do you hit a golf ball? So, whatever it takes. This has not been the position of the Board of Medical Examiners for many, many years. And if they are changing, I would be very, very surprised, very pleasantly surprised. One thing I do disagree with was the comments of Dr. Hicks last week that requires a second doctor to approve of treatment. Dr. Hicks is an anesthesiologist. He never had to treat a chronic pain patient. And furthermore, he never had to ask any other doctor, am I doing the right treatment?
Dr. Levesque.
Yes, sir.
We're really rushed for time this morning, and I'd appreciate it if we could just speak directly to 1141, or 1140 here at the moment. And I realize
okay.
Time related.
Yes, sir. I am totally in favor of 1140. I believe that 1140, establishing a committee for the evaluation of chronic pain, is going to help every patient in the state of Oregon. And I am, as a representative of AARP, I am totally in favor of this, and I'm sure that AARP is also.
Thank you very much. I'm going to open public hearing for work session on Senate Bill 1140.
You want a motion?
Let's see, we have one amendment. No, we didn't have any amendments.
One amendment. Huh?
Yes.
Is there an amendment? Of course. No, not in court. I move 1140 to the floor with a defense.
Yes. Senator Duncan moves Senate Bill 1140 to the floor with a defense recommendation. Further discussion?
I have a comment.
Yes.
I just want to thank all those doctors that do listen to their patients and do help them, and I want to give them every tool that we can.
There are no further objections. Again, see if Senator Shields is available. I'll ask the clerk to call the roll.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Chairman?
Aye.
Commissioner?
Aye. Let's see, stick your head in here long enough. Here's the book. Okay, since Bill 1140 has been passed through the committee with the due pass recommendation and Senator Duke, oh, excuse me, I'm sorry. Reopen the work session. Go ahead and 1140. Okay, it has passed. Senator Duke, do you wish to carry this? Does she have to leave?
Okay.
Okay, we'll ask her to carry it.
Okay.
I'm sure
that she will.
Okay. Senator Duke will be the carrier. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1141, and Senator Duke will be retrieved. Again, Simon Paquette and Margaret Carley, Jane Myers. Thanks,
Professor. Thanks for having me today. My name is Simon Paquette. I'm a licensed clinical social worker with a background in pain medication management and hospice. What I'm talking to you about this morning is my support for Senate Bill 1141. And the reason I'm supporting it is that it's the most economically reasonable approach to funding a process for advocacy for those in pain and their doctors. We have an ombudsman process for long-term care. We have no effective impartial person who can step forward and advocate for the patient or the doctor at this time. I did so for one patient and saw referrals drop off by a third for the hospice I administered. I discovered early on that being right and fighting for clients' rights has a price. One time a family came to me concerned their dying father was no longer going to be treated by a doctor that had cared for him. I carefully advised them to approach the administrator of the clinic and advise that person of their concerns. The problem got dealt with and the administrator intervened. What about the patient without an effective advocate or an intimidated family? Oregonian patients and their families need an objective problem solver and advocate who does not fear for their job or referrals. Please consider funding 1141 as a small investment for patient family well-being.
Good morning again. Senator Carley with Oregon Healthcare, Chair Fisher. Oregon Healthcare supports the creation of a chronic pain ombudsman within the Department of Human Resources. We believe, again, that this will provide a valuable resource and someone who the social workers and other advocates in our facilities can contact on behalf of patients who are suffering pain and need assistance. We think that this is a viable option and involves, we know you have a very tight budget this session and it involves essentially using some existing resources and some additional resources to fund this position. And we ask that for your support. Thank you.
Chairman Fisher, members of the committee, I'm Jane Myers representing the Oregon Dental Association. We support Senate Bill 1141. Our representative on the task force, Dr. Rademacher, treats temporomandibular joint disorders and oral facial pain and is very knowledgeable about that. And because of some of his recommendations, we've already started a process with OHSU and the Board of Dentistry to discuss other kinds of issues, including pain, that are affecting the dental community. But we support the bill because we see a need to coordinate further with other healthcare practitioners to collect information about chronic pain, and TMJ disorder is very broadly discriminated against in insurance contracts for both coverage and the amount of coverage, and yet there are a lot of people suffering from this disorder. Thank you.
Senator Dukes, then. Yes, excuse me.
Okay, you can have some more witnesses up. I'll have some questions a little bit later.
Senator Dukes and Gary Weeks. Thank you once again, Senator.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Joan Dukes, State Senator from District 1, and here on Senate Bill 1141. They time me better this time. Senate Bill 1141, I hope you have a hand engrossed. We're having a little trouble getting the amendment to dash one, I'm assuming it would be the dash one, out of legislative council, but we've made a few proposed changes to the bill, and so you should have a hand engrossed version in front of you.
I don't believe we do.
And
or do we?
We started out with a sort of a pared-down version of what the Payment Symptom Management Task Force proposed, an ombudsman and located in DHR. And as Mr. Weeks and I had conversations, it became aware that but what we wanted to get to and what we were proposing were slightly different things, and that's why you have Hannah Grove. And I'm actually going to be quiet here other than tell you I think it's a great proposal. And let Mr. Weiss talk, because I get excited about the possibilities every time I talk with him about it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Gary Weeks, Director of the Department of Human Resources, and I've frankly gotten much more excited about this bill the more I've worked with Senator Dukes on it. The amendments that you have, actually the hand engrossed version, I guess I should say, changes the original bill somewhat in the sense that we're creating what we're describing as a pain management advocate rather than an ombudsman. The function, the way the bill originally described, is not really so much an ombudsman activity as it is an advocacy activity, one where the advocate would work to coordinate and facilitate and advocate for people who have chronic pain in their lives, and a position that would work statewide to provide training and education and information to healthcare providers, consumers, consumers' families, and so on about chronic pain management. And then also work to try to develop funds to support regional conferences and research related to pain management. What's not said in this hand engrossed version, but what clearly is implied here is that there'll be a very close working relationship between the advocate within DHR and the Health Division as well as the Task Force. So Health Division Task Force and a position located in the department would be very closely aligned and working together. It would be our intent, if you pass this bill as amended, to house the position, the advocacy position, in the Community Partnership Team, which is a unit in my office that deals with lifespan respite care, which I should say is a bill that was written last time almost exactly like this in terms of the job responsibilities for education, training, research, and so on. So we would align it with the respite care program, with the AmeriCorps program, with our service integration programs, with our RAP program, which is reducing teen pregnancy. All of those are outreach, research, educational. They all do conferencing, and they all raise grants and so on like that. So there's a place within the director's office where we can support this sort of an operation and support it pretty efficiently and you know, pretty reasonably priced, I think, too. So that's the nature of the bill. And if I've left something out that Senator Dukes thought should be in here, what are we going to go to questions? But it's a very exciting proposal, and I think gives us, for the first time, a real opportunity, just as we did in lifespan respite care, to begin to deal with chronic pain management across systems and across the state.
This is the advocacy piece of the whole package that you're seeing this session. This person, I expect, will talk to people around the state, will, and if we're successful in getting securing grant monies to do it, we may actually put on a conference on pain management. This is the person that will coordinate all of the resources in one place so that people in pain will finally have some place to go to get the information. Today, there's an incredible underground network out there, but there isn't one place you can go to get it all.
Mr. Chairman, I should add one other caveat that I feel responsibility to say, and that is that this position and the resources for it, while they're not substantial in terms of is not in the governor's budget, and I have a compelling need to tell you that right now. So
I'm still out there looking for money.
Senator Shields.
Gary, what do you get in Senate Bill 141 that you don't get in Senate Bill 22?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Shields, they're very similar bills. I mean, in terms of the responsibilities of the Office of Pain Management, which is what's described in 22, That office is similar to the advocate. So if you lay the two bills side by side, you'll see the same thing. The difference is in Senate Bill 22, it locates the Office of Chronic Pain Management in the Health Division. And there's a direct tie in 22 by language to the task force, the Chronic Pain Management Task Force. But other than that, you know, where it's located, maybe more direct tie to the task force, the responsibilities, at least as I read them in the two bills, are basically the same. Same kind of housing, same kind of retirement, to raise grants and develop conferences and so on like that.
Mr. Chair, this is kind of a follow-up question, and I guess I'm asking you because, like, Senator Dukes was still down in the streams, fish enhancement, whatever committee started at 7 o'clock this morning. I'm still trying to catch up. I should say I'm swimming upstream, I suppose. My question, I guess, is what happens if you pass both 1141 and 22? Both of them create the ombudsman, and they put them in different places?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Shields, I don't think you'd want to do that.
But we got them both on the list.
The choice here. You have two bills where the work of the bills, the outreach and so on, is similar in both bills. It's a question of, do you feel that this ought to be a part of the Health Division specifically, or is there a connection to a broader department mission that it's in VHR, a connection to respite care and other, and also support that's in VHR that might be a little cheaper than in the Health Division, in the sense that, not that the Health Division is less efficient, but I'm already supporting an outreach efforts within VHR, and there's some economies of scale, quite frankly. I think the key thing is keeping the connection between the advocate that describes in 1141 and the Health Division and the task force. And I'm here to tell you those connections would continue under the bill that Senator Gates is proposing.
As I understand it, Senate Bill 22 would require basically an office and staff and considerable more expense than what's provided for in 1141, and yet probably work pretty much toward the same goal.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
I'm catching up here.
Yeah.
What catches my attention, and I certainly respect Senator Dukes, but the one comes at the request of the Pain Symptom Management Task Force, and the other comes at the request of Senator Dukes, and I'm just wondering which one of these two is supposed to be the state-of-the-art, whatever we're getting trying to get to, you know what I'm saying? So what is maybe the task force people want to talk about that too? You know, it seems like there might be more upfront money with Senate Bill 22 from the governor's, or that's not in the governor's budget, and less upfront money that's not in the governor's budget with 1141, right? But both of them could raise money from foundations. I'm just asking for help here. Sorry, it's Monday morning.
Grant Higginson is here to speak to the Senate Bill 22. Would it be helpful if Grant joined us at the table and
I would not turn it down?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, let me tell you what I told the task force when they said, why did you introduce Senate Bill 1141? This is my third session in pain and symptom management work, and I have come to deal in reality. And sometimes what you'd really like to get at, like the last one we were talking about pain as a diagnosis, and then what you do to get to that point, sometimes what you do to get there is not what you would like to have for the full thing. And it occurred to me that this session, that coming in and asking for a new office in the Health Division probably wasn't a good thing to bring to the legislature. So I pared the bill down, and then I've been working with Mr. Weeks to try to get into something that I think is truly exciting. So that's why the difference. The task force asked for exactly what they wanted, and that's a great thing. And if you can come up with some more money and want to give us that, then I think we can achieve this basically the same thing, less expensively this way.
In other words, the task force, Mr. Chair, okay, if I ask another question.
Yes.
The task force asked for the $22 version, and you're asking for the $11.41 version.
Senator Duncan, go ahead. You got a question? There's been some preliminary work, and not official, but a preliminary work on potential expense for the different bills. It's estimated about almost $162,000 for the SB 22 and around $94,000 for the SB 1141. So not quite twice, but it's considerably more.
Mr. Chairman, in fairness, on the fiscal, on the 141 estimate, we only made that for 20 months, and I think Grant priced the other one at 24 months. And the reason we did 20 months is, for practical purposes, the session ends July 1st. You're not going to hire somebody July 1st, you know. Jim, by the time you write the position six and so on, you get ready to hire someone. For almost all state positions, you're actually looking at 20, 21 months worth of actual expenditure and stuff. So there is some difference there. There are some costs that the health division would have that we might not. In other words, if it's housed in DHR, I'm just going to find a cubicle for this position within the community partnerships, and we will share the clerical responsibilities and website development and so on like that will be done by the same people that work on those things for other things like respite care and AmeriCorps and service integration projects. So there's some economies there that the health division might have, but I want to make sure you don't see the differences double. There's some differences just in the way the calculations were made.
Well, there's about 0.42 FTE difference, so
that's true, Senator.
So there definitely is. Considering that they would probably be on a par salary wise and so forth, there is a considerable difference.
Still is.
Grant, go ahead.
Senator Fisher, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson, and I am a state health officer and deputy administrator for the Oregon Health Division. And first, I just want to echo some of the things that Gary said. I agree that it's an either 1141 or Senate Bill 22, because they're basically doing the same thing. I also would agree that they conceptually really are doing the same thing, and I'm not sure where the difference in the fiscal impact is, because my understanding is basically we're talking about the same number of people. We're talking about a one professional staff person who would be the advocate position, and then clerical support staff. The task, the Senate Bill 22 basically is the wording that was taken directly from the task force report. And we had a lot of discussion about where was the best place to house an office or a position, because really what we're saying here is we think that there needs to be a focus in state government on pain and symptoms management. And I never was trying to build an empire around chronic pain at the health division and said that a number of I think the reason that it fell to the health division was because I was the state agency person on the task force, and the task force grew comfortable with the idea of housing it within the health division. I think that conceptually, as long as we have the two major functions performed by this person, I think the task force would be comfortable with that. And the two major functions are, one, being that advocate for patients and for families, and also an advocate and a resource provider for healthcare providers as well. And then the other portion is to help forward on, to help move forward some of the other recommendations of the Pain and Symptoms Management Task Force, things like the regional conferences, things like advocating for changes in the Oregon Health Plan. And as long as those functions are provided by wherever this position is, I think the task force would be amenable to that. And also, I have been in some of the with Mr. Weeks and the head of the community partnership team and the ombudsman office at DHR, and we've all agreed that the health division and myself would stay involved with this position and with these activities.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
This is my final question on this. You just mentioned that in no way would you be setting up an empire, and you've addressed that before. I just want to make sure that within the task force itself, as one of these goes together, that there's no conflict of interest on the part of anybody in the task force, in any way trying to set up for themselves a future job or, whatever. Any response to that kind of comment?
Well, I'll go back to Dr. Higginson, the fact that it was discussed, and I don't recall that we had any input from Gary Weeks and possibly not even Senator Dukes on that particular issue, because Senator Dukes did attend a few times on the Pain and Symptoms Management, was not a member there, and I don't recall that that ever came up in particular, but I don't think there was any attempt by, nothing that I ever saw by any of the members of the committee to try to push themselves into a position of
great gain. That was an attempt at all. However, I will tell you that we had 30 incredibly well-qualified people on that task force.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wouldn't, I mean, if some of them should apply for any of these things, I think we would be very fortunate.
Alicia Super would have been here probably today had not she, there was apparently a death in the family, and for that we'd send her our best wishes and our feelings of sympathy for that, and sorry that she couldn't make it.
But they are all employed people, to the best of my knowledge. They're all out there doing something today.
Go ahead.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Shields, yeah, I am unaware that that was, you know, an underlying agenda of anyone on either one of these bills, and my understanding is that the hiring procedures would be standard state agency hiring procedures, which would be an open competitive process.
Any further questions?
I just have one comment. It seems to me, I'm not really involved in this, although I support all the efforts. It seems to me the barrier is the Board of Medical Examiners. Is this the best way we can get to them to help these people in pain?
Well, I think the Board of Medical Examiners was very, very cognizant of that, because Kathleen Haley attended those meetings, as did Judge Hicks. And they certainly, that was brought up time and time and again, and was one of the central themes of restriction on patients having access to these medications was a fear of doctors and reprisal from the Board of Medical Examiners.
Mr. Chair and Senator Fisher, the Board of Medical Examiners really was a active and good participant throughout the task force. Clearly, one of the things that we did hear from both patients and providers was that there was a lot of concern around the Board of Medical Examiners. My personal belief, and this is what the Board of Medical Examiners presented, was that things really have changed from 10 years ago. They are trying to be much, much more in tune with what patients need today in the way of pain management, and that a lot of the problems that we were hearing was either misperception by the patients or their providers, or simply not knowing where the Board of Medical Examiners currently stands. And clearly, though, wherever this position was, if this goes forward, that one of the roles of that advocate would be to work with the Board of Medical Examiners, and there are a number of recommendations that came out of the task force for things that the board should be doing and other boards should be doing to help improve pain and symptoms management.
Okay, I know you're under time, we think, Senator. I just want to say that it just seems like if they would get educated, all this expense wouldn't be necessary.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Shannon, we also have to educate the public, and I think that's one of the bigger challenges before us. At last session, when I was working on the task force bill, the Board of Medical Examiners came to me and said, we'd like to participate. They were familiar with, I mean, they knew the past, and they knew what was out there in perception, and they wanted to be able to correct that and get past it, and I think they have. It just takes almost nothing, as you know, to get something out. To correct it takes an awful lot, and I think that's what they're still working under. But I'm excited about the possibility of educating all kinds of people. And I think the pain patients bill of rights that you passed out last week will also help the Board of Medical Examiners, because it sets things out there that, with any luck, will encourage people, if they are running into some of the horror stories that you've heard, to report to the Board of Medical Examiners and give them the chance to deal with it.
Here we have one more person to testify, Dr. Jackson. I think our staff snatched the paper right out from under your hand.
Yeah, okay.
still have 1, 2, 3, 4 bills to go, and you got to get out of here in 25 minutes. So,
yeah.
If
Senator Fisher, members of the committee, I believe that Senator Shannon's comments just a few minutes ago about the intimidation by the Board of Medical Examiners has been made completely obvious to almost everybody. And I have stated, I sent a fax on Thursday afternoon, I believe, maybe Friday sometime, that if you don't think physicians are intimidated about the treatment for chronic pain, ask any doctor.
Mm-hmm.
They'll tell you that there's a sword hanging over their heads, and they don't like this, and they know that if the board thinks, or somebody on the board thinks that they're giving too much pain medication, first thing they're going to get a letter which freezes their blood, and if they get a second letter, they may lose their license or get their license restricted so they can't give adequate pain medication. And this is my main point, and I think this would be the main point of any physician who sat here. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.
Do you agree with me, please?
Yes.
Thank
what I'm trying to bring up.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
We're going to close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 1141.
Move the
dash one.
Dash
one. No.
You don't have to. Yeah, we don't have a dash one.
We don't have the dash ones yet. They won't be ready until the discussion. The dash ones won't be out until later on this afternoon.
Oh, okay. So we'll bring it back in for.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1141 and time when we get a hold of the dash one amendments. I'm going to skip Senate Bill 22. I think it's been fairly well discussed and they had nobody signed up to speak with it to it. I'm going to pass over Senate Bill 1027 momentarily and go to Senate Bill 1158 and want to have a public hearing on Senate Bill 1158. Mike Willis, Sherry Downs, and Norma Trimble, and those of you that are in wheelchairs will try to accommodate and work you up here as easily as we can. Little, you're right, Mike. You're making it right. There you go. Notice you got your name in the paper. Just yeah, Mike.
A friend of mine said, "I've never heard you say you were confused about anything before."
Go ahead, Mike.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee. My name's Mike Willis. In the interest of time, and I know you have other things to do. So let me say we have people here from Bend and Klamath Falls to testify that I know would be very important, Mr. Chair. How much time do you want us to take?
Just be as brief as you can, and but
okay.
Provide time for this, though.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1158 is a funding bill for Centers for Independent Living. Centers are in many ways a little confusing from the start, and we want to try and explain to you what they are, because we fully understand that at some point in this legislature, we need an advocate. At some point when you're making the hard decisions about where dollars go, you need to understand what Centers for Independent Living do and care about them enough to say that this is an important change in direction for the state to move in, that it's an important thing for the state to do because it represents a different kind of commitment than we've made in the past, and an essential kind of commitment if people with disabilities are going to obtain the kinds of independence and freedom that they need to obtain. We've done an excellent job in Oregon in many ways trying to help people with disabilities in terms of medical care,
We've done much in terms of in-home attendant care programs, et cetera. We have other kinds of programs that we've worked on. Independent living centers are different. They are community-based programs. They exist at this point in Portland, Bend, Klamath Falls, Roseburg, and the Medford Grand Pass area. They are programs operated by people with disabilities, for people with disabilities. They provide some essential focus in terms of what people with disabilities need. And what do I mean by that? That every test as far as worst nightmare, my notes, I can't read them. All right. Well, okay. Centers for Independent Living provide people with disabilities in their own home communities the opportunity to receive skill training and independence. The most pervasive effect of initial disability is isolation. Isolation in terms of communication and in terms of travel. So when a person is disabled, their initial reaction is to think about what they can't do, where they can't go, who they can't see, and that they can't work. Without exposure to people with disabilities who can teach them the kind of skills they need to have, teach them not from the rehabilitation professional perspective or the medical perspective, but from the perspective of a person with a disability. Without that kind of focus, many people never begin the process of really and truly becoming independent. What I'd like you to do this morning is hear from people both who are on boards of independent living centers and consumers of services. We also have a staff member here to talk to you about the kinds of services that the agencies provide. And any questions you have along the way, we would be more than happy to answer. At this point, Mr. Chair, if we could, I'd like you to hear from Sherry Downs, who is from the Independent Living Resources Center in Portland, who can talk about what kinds of services specifically independent living centers provide, as well as the kinds of things they're not able to do at this point because of the lack of funding. Sherry?
Good morning, Chair and committee members. I don't think you can hear me. It is a privilege to be here this morning, and as a person with hidden disabilities and chronic pain kinds of issues that was being talked about earlier, I find that independent living is one of the places that it's very important to find support and advocacy to stay independent and to be able to manage in a community setting. A lot of the kinds of secondary things that I find with people that I work with in groups and individually and in the youth services component, there is a secondary depression because of the isolation that was mentioned, and sometimes the sense of hopelessness when barriers are too great and there's no one, on an ally on your side. So the services that we do in the Portland Center are really services that consumers, the folks that come to us with disabilities, have asked for. And we have a wide variety of people that come to us with different kinds of disabilities, physical disabilities, cognitive disabilities, learning disabilities. The wide range of kinds of disabilities are represented in the people that come into the center. And we have core services on advocacy, support, information and referral, and we get, with Portland being a metropolitan area, we get a lot of people are confused about where to go and what services in the urban setting, so we do a lot of support of information and referral. And we also find that we develop unique kinds of programs because we get the requests to do those, and so we have the flexibility to respond to that. I am particularly invested in the youth programs and the mentor projects that are going on, and we have a wide range of programs where we train and support mentors to extend services. We do a Take Charge program, which Norma is one of the parents of one of the young people that I work with in Take Charge, and she'll tell you a little bit about that program. I believe that in helping people with disabilities have the support and someone believing in them, that we can remain independent, and we can also help people who are not independent gain that independence. And it's a very cost-effective way of keeping the community alive and keeping people following their dreams. I am very, I feel it's very important that this bill gets moved forward, because we get requests for services that were really stretched to the limit and are having to have people wait for that. We could shorten that and not have that kind of thing occurring. As we outreach to youth, we're getting more youth and parents and families that are needing support, and we're not able to serve as many as we'd like. And we don't have a staff. And even with the extension, by serving and training mentors, we're still very tight. And so I would really like your support in this, in order for us to continue to do the good services that we're doing and expand to reach those people that we're not able to serve. Thank you.
Sure, there's current funding that's going on the 5 independent programs. And there's a current funding, and then there's an SB 1158 funding. Are you familiar with the comparison of UDP this?
No, I don't have a copy.
Maybe if I could just hand this to you. I have an extra copy. I'd like this. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I just kind of wanted to have you put on the record there with current funding and explain maybe where those funds come from, and then how the funding under SB 1158 would.
Yeah, I think that one of the folks in the testimony was going to speak to this, but I'll do as best I can. just looking at it right now, I know that there's a need to expand and improve services and to do more public education and awareness kinds of things. And these funds would be spread throughout the 5 centers in the state, so it wouldn't be all directly going to services that I'm talking about in Portland, because I'm just representing the direct service staff and the peer counselors in Portland.
Mr. Chair, what I tried to do is I put that document together for you was to show you what the current funding levels are. The significant note for Portland is that we're asking for around $400,000 in total funding for that program if you add the two numbers together. Because about half the disability population in the state lives in Portland, the other centers we would bring up to a level of $200,000 in the rest of the state with Senate Bill 1158 funding. The difficulty at this point is that the centers around the state are so underfunded they can't get any momentum to then go out and look for other kinds of community grants, et cetera. They simply don't reach critical mass when they're struggling to and overwhelmed with the kinds of services that they have to provide and the inability to meet the needs that they have. They simply can't get their feet on the ground in order to really go out then and search for those other kinds of funds. So we're asking for $200,000 for each of the centers and then $400,000 for Portland in order to help each of these centers really get a stable funding base.
I was wondering if, because the figures don't balance, there's 600 under current funding for Portland, $674,126, and
right.
Under 1158, $125,874.
That gets them up to $800,000. That's a biennium figure, and that essentially is what they would need in order to have $400,000 a year in total funding. Those are all biennial figures. I should make that clear, I guess.
Yeah. Okay, well, so their current funding, yes, the 1158 would add that much more, or
yes.
Just guarantee that they had?
It would add that much more to each program.
So they would have $400,000 and $200,000 per year in the other 4?
Yes.
Okay. I saw, you know.
Sorry, I should have put a total column on there. You never turn a blind man over to a budget job, huh?
I remember you said that.
Mr. Chair, at this point, if you'd like, we could hear from Norma Trimble. Her son, Isaac, was involved in independent living, and I thought it might be interesting from a parent's perspective to see the kinds of effects that it had in terms of her son.
Yes, go ahead, Norma.
Senator Fisher, Chair Fisher and members of the committee. I'm here today to testify as a parent. My name is Norma Trimble. I'm here to testify on the benefits that my son has experienced after attending a Take Charge Summer Institute program developed and especially designed for independent living centers by Dr. Lori Powers at the National Center on Self-Determination. This last summer, my then 16-year-old son, Isaac, had a very macho, bad attitude about school, and his overall view on life as a teenager with a disability and continuing to school, he had already decided to drop out. Since Counselor Sherry Downs at ILR had suggested a summer program, which is the Take Charge Summer Institute, and he suggested this program for personal development and much-needed school credit. At the time, as a sophomore, Isaac only had 4 high school credits due to his disability and very poor attendance. Isaac felt like most teenagers that there just wasn't anything else anyone could teach him about functioning and with his disability, which he tried very hard to hide with his attitude. Through this program, Isaac learned about self-advocacy to advocate for his peers with disabilities, his and their legal rights per ADA law. This was done through several different exercises which involved Isaac and 4 other students with various disabilities. One exercise in particular was for the group of 5 students to travel by city bus to a given address. The students quickly learned from one another of their everyday struggles and barriers as well as their abilities to function. Not all buildings or businesses to the addresses given were always accessible. This is where they learned and taught each other about what ADA means and how it individually affected them. Each day, Isaac would come home with a different experience to share about advocacy and his newfound ways of communicating to others about his disability. After the end of the 2-week program, Isaac, along with other students, were begging the counselors to extend the program for another 2 weeks. The program also taught Isaac to take charge of his academic life and how to put together his own IEP meetings, which he did the following fall. With continued support of Sherry Downs at ILR throughout the summer, he learned more on doing the IEP meetings and being more comfortable with teachers and administrators, principals, and so on. Isaac went back to the Metropolitan Learning Center that he had attended for 4 years, and with the support of the independent living counselor as part of the team of key people brought together by Isaac, he was able to openly communicate his disability and plan for his graduation. As a result of the IEP meeting, Isaac transferred to the Vocational Village High School, where he is enrolled in the welding vocational program. Isaac is now 17. And was able to make up and retrieve a total of 14 credits towards graduation so far. Isaac is very proud of himself and has made the school newsletter for having better than 80% attendance. I mean, as a parent, I mean, to have him go to school. Before, he was just going to school to hang out. People just didn't understand his disability because he had no way to communicate that. He just was really shut off. By the time he was 16 with a disability, his disability, problems with parts of his brain enjoyment, and people just, you know, look at him while he's just dumb or slow, or sometimes schools would just say he was mostly retarded. But he learned through other children and other kids his age and younger, and with various types of disabilities that this program at ILR is able to bring together. So new teachers say that they never noticed him showing the type of negative attitude at his new school. Mr. Reese and at his metal class, and I quoted him, he says, I wish I had 10 more like him. When he first did start at Vocational Village, he thought it wasn't really going to make that much of a difference. It was still a public school system that he saw, and the first 2 weeks were kind of rough for him. But after that, he was able to bring the team back together and had Sherry Downs come and have Sherry explain what sensory overload was and an open meeting with Isaac present, which was a first for Isaac. Usually in IEP meetings that we had before, Isaac wasn't included. And he was able to communicate, you know, and really come forward. And the teachers really, you know, were down that the student with disability was able to do this after all this time. And he now teaches a class twice a week in the welding class at Vocational Village. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify.
You're welcome. Thank you for coming. We have then
Jan Fizzo, Don Stewart, and Tina Frazier. Shuffling the chairs for us. Go right ahead, Jan.
Come here, he said. We can't. We're afraid. Come here, he said. We can't. We're afraid. Come here, he said. We did. He pushed. We flew. Good morning. I'm here today to speak about the importance of flying. My name is Jan Fizzo. I am a person who experiences disability and the Vice President of the Board of Central Oregon Resources for Independent Living, or CORAL. I volunteer for CORAL because I believe so strongly in the philosophy of the independent living movement. Independent living is about empowerment. It is about self-responsibility and self-respect. The movement rejects the idea that experiencing a disability means becoming a burden on society. The services provided by CORAL help not only the individual, but family and friends as well. As someone learns to become as self-reliant as possible, things get better for everyone involved. People served by our independent living center have moved from financial dependence on the state to full employment. While this is not the reality for everyone, helping people achieve their maximum potential is our goal. SB 1158 assists the independent living movement in fulfilling one of my father's favorite axioms. It is about giving a hand up, not a hand out. As a member of the CORAL board, I have the invaluable opportunity to view the organization from all sides. Not only do I see the success stories, but I also learn about the frustration and overwork of the staff. The frustration lies in knowing that many people in the community are falling through the cracks because of scarce resources, overworked because the staff is so often trying to do more than is humanly possible. Additionally, I am actively involved in making policy that determines the programs and goals of our center. The board is ultimately responsible for the direction of CORAL and must sometimes make tough choices due to resource limitations. As an individual with both education and work experience in the field of not-for-profit accounting, I am keenly aware of the financial issues facing independent living centers. I can assure everyone here that our board takes this responsibility very seriously. We endeavor to ensure that our resources are wisely and efficiently spent. Not only is CORAL concerned about using our funds effectively, but we also provide services and opportunities that can serve public dollars. For example, each individual that an independent living center helps move from a nursing home to an assisted living facility or from an assisted living facility to their own apartment saves the government $1,000 or more per month. We know that many more people in our area can transition out of nursing homes or assisted living facilities with help. The problem is a lack of funding for the staff positions required. This is just one reason why SB 1158 is so important. It provides opportunities that are simply not otherwise available. We know we make a difference. One of our consumers moved from a nursing home to an assisted living facility to her own apartment with the help of CORAL staff. Independent living is about taking personal responsibility to the greatest extent possible. It is about possibilities and having the opportunity to explore options. It is about risks, the chance to try something and the freedom to fail. It is about human potential. Each time a board or staff member learns of someone who wants independent living services, we want to act. Unfortunately, with our current resources, we can help only a fraction of those requesting our services. This is not only costly to the individual and their family, but is an unnecessary burden on society. With your support, we can reduce this burden. We can help people fly. Thank you.
Our time is fleeting, so if you can abbreviate or
put the statements in your own words instead of maybe just reading a complete letter. I would appreciate it because we would like to try to move this this morning, and I'm speaking. Go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Don Stewart. I'm the Executive Director of Central Oregon Resources for Independent Living in Bend. We serve the primarily rural counties of Crook, Jefferson, and Deschutes. I'm going to be talking just for a brief period this morning on an aspect of our of what we do that I believe is really a major help in causing us to be effective in working with people who experience disability. And it's not one of our services, it's an outcome of our services. And it's called quality of life. Try to imagine for a moment that in the recent past, you or someone that you loved has had an accident in a car or an operation for a tumor or a heart attack or a stroke in some way or other, and you've ended up with a disability. Now you've completed all of the help that you can get through from the medical community, and you're sitting at home or in a nursing home or in some place else, and you're looking at your life and you're saying, my gosh, I'm alive, but is the life I have left worth living? And then someone, maybe a rehabilitation counselor or the nurse at the doctor's office or someone at Senior and Disabled Services says, hey, there's an independent living center that maybe you should check out. These people maybe can help you. And so you give it a try, and here's what you discover. You find out that there's a lot of other people who have experienced what you've experienced and are feeling many of the same things that you're feeling. You also find out that many of these people are working at this independent living center or volunteering there. And these people are there to help you. You're not hopeless, and you're not helpless. You have options, and all you really needed was to find somebody who knew what those options were and were willing to tell you what they were. These people do a lot of things together. We go to parties, camping, Reno, bowling, picnics, even skiing. You do have a social life possible to you. They'll train you to learn more skills so that you can be more independent. They'll help you learn more skills so that you can get a job and get more independent in the job. But there's a catch. And you'd often think, yeah, I knew there must be a catch to this somewhere. But you have to be willing to help yourself if you're going to get independent living services. We help you, but we won't do it for you. Independent living people, as Jan said, believe in giving you a hand up, not a hand out. Quality of life is even more precious when you realize that you might never have experienced it again. In this environment, you begin to realize that you can do more than you ever thought you could, and that you're treated free to try anything. You might fail, but that's okay, and there's people all around you who are willing to tell you that it's okay. You know, failure is not failing to achieve what you're trying. Failure is being unwilling to try to achieve what you can. Opportunities are different when you're disabled, but you still have lots of opportunities and lots of potential, and it's your choice. You get to decide. In this kind of an environment, ordinary people can accomplish extraordinary things. They just need to be given an opportunity. In Central Oregon, we have more than 10,000 people in this three-county area who experience what the federal government defines as significant disabilities. Last year, with the funding we have, we were able to serve 262 different people. And with the funding that's proposed in Senate Bill 1158, we could more than double the number of people we serve. Now, someone might think, well, for heaven's sakes, you're talking, you know, a little over 500 people out of 10,000. That's hardly worth messing with. You know, it doesn't even make a difference. And that thought reminds me just briefly of a story that I heard about a little boy that was walking along the beach, and there had been a big storm the night before, and lots of starfish had been washed up on the beach. The little boy was
leaning down and picking up starfish and flinging them back into the water. And the sun was coming up, and the starfish were going to be dying in the heat of the sun, the ones left up on the beach. A man watched the little kid for a while, and then he went over and he said, "Son, don't you realize there are thousands of starfish on this beach, and what you're doing isn't going to really make any significant difference?" The little boy reached down and he picked up another starfish and he threw it back into the water, and then he looked up at the man and he smiled and he said, "Sir, you're probably right, but it made a difference for that one." Now, I'd like to ask you, please, please, help us make a difference for people who need it, and thank you very much.
Chairman Fisher and members of the committee, my name is Tina Treasure, and I came prepared this morning to talk to you from really two perspectives, and I'm going to cut it short because I know that you're short on time. The two perspectives is that I'm the director of a Center for Independent Living, actually the first rural center in the state in Klamath Falls called Spokes Unlimited. And I also wanted to tell you my story as a person with a severe disability who really credits independent living for changing my life. So because I think that's the most part, that's the important part that will illustrate why you should support IL, that's the one I'm going to spend my time on. When I was 18 years old, I was injured in a car accident. I broke my neck, damaged my spinal cord, and I lost the use of my legs and a lot of my upper body mobility and strength. For the next year, actually 2 days short of a year, I was in a hospital. And during that time, I really developed what I call a medical model view of my disability, meaning that's all I focused on day and night. The people around me and myself considered that I was sick, not disabled. That's really different. And even though I hate the word, I really became a cripple. And I don't mean that I just had a disability, but I let that disability change who I was and what I did. During the next 7.5 years, I really did little for myself. I didn't work. I didn't drive a car. I didn't clean my own house. I really let my family do just about everything imaginable for me. And I ask myself that a lot now as to why did I do that? Because I wasn't uneducated. Really, I wasn't sheltered from life experience, but I had never really been around anybody with a disability. And I had a wonderful family who wanted to take care of me. And they were told, as I was, that that's the way it needed to be. And so that's the way it was. And I guess reality says that a car accident changed my life, and I thought at that time it changed it forever. But what I really want to share with you is the happy side of that story is that one Saturday, 7 years after that, I attended a support group for people with disabilities. And there I met people who, like myself, used wheelchairs. And while you think that's not odd because I spent all this time in the hospital, I did meet a lot of people that used chairs. These people were talking about things that I didn't think people with disabilities cared about or thought about anymore. There was a lady there talking about, you know, we really have to do something about the curbs downtown. I have to pop up and down 9 curbs every morning on my way to work. And others at this meeting were appalled at how many curbs she had to pop up. And I wasn't thinking about that. What I was concentrating on was the fact she said, on my way to work. There was a guy there that was talking about going to a grocery store and that we really have to do something about the parking there because people block my van and I'm not able to get in and out. People were thinking, well, we have to do something about that. Well, the whole time I was sitting there thinking, well, who took him to the store and why did he have to go? It's not something I ever did. And I remember he said he drove there. And I can tell you, it's pretty embarrassing to have to tell you that those things were real foreign to me because it seems like I was pretty sheltered. But I didn't understand I could do those things for myself. And people that know me now find this hard to believe because I'm not a person of a few words.
Having met you in D-Stack.
Yeah. I am really different now. But, and at that meeting, that first meeting, I can remember a bit. I didn't say anything. All I did was introduce myself, and that's the part people find really hard to believe. But, you know, I remember that day like it was yesterday because at that meeting, I met people who started expecting things from me, and I started expecting things from myself. And I think that was the beginning of the end of me thinking of my disability as an excuse to be dependent.
And today I am a really different person, as Senator Fisher said. And you're finding out I'm not a few words anymore. But I do drive. I've actually been employed for 10 years. I work 50, 60, sometimes 70-hour week because I have a job I dearly love. I drive a modified van all over the state. I serve on state and national committees. I'm a real active member of my community. What I'm not anymore is crippled. Yes, I have a disability, but those are very, very different things. And what I just want to tell you is those are some of the emotional reasons why I want you to support independent living. But I hope you'll take time and read my testimony, because in it I included some facts and figures about how much my independence has saved the government and money, the opportunity for me to give back instead of take. But I do want to add that I would use the last breath in me to fight for those programs to exist, because they're necessary. But they're not necessary for someone like me who only used them because I didn't know there was any other way. So I know we're short on time, but if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them for you.
Great story. Thank you. Mr. Chair, I have a cousin who has lost both legs because of diabetes. My gosh, he doesn't let anything stop him. And I always think, well, when you feel kind of depressed, you go see him, he'll cheer you up. He's got an attitude that's just unbelievable.
Well, he'd be perfect to work at a center for independent living, because it's that kind of attitude that we need to help others realize their potential.
A great story he was telling about moving the sprinkler system, got up and fell down. He couldn't balance. The sprinkler just kept coming around, hitting him in the face all the time, you know. But he has great stories to tell.
Well, thank you very much. We hope you'll help us give those opportunities to the other people that are waiting, because there are a lot of them. Thank you.
That makes me feel kind of...
Senator Fisher.
Yes.
Even while others are coming to testify, we do want to get this out of committee. I'd like to urge everybody here to make sure that they go to the Ways and Means, because that's the hard part of this. They need to hear this kind of testimony in the next round.
Yes. You made my speech for me, because that was going to be my direction to them. Don't stop now.
We'll all be there and many more. Yeah, well, just bring 10 for each one of you next time.
What's your plan, Mr. Chair? I've got three more people that have asked to testify on this. Ellie Jenny and Mr. Westwood. Rick. That was okay. Okay, we'll just put her down as supporting this. Okay. So, Mr. Westwood, come right ahead. Yes, and Rick Berger. Okay, just make your way down here quickly, and
we could vote on it and then take your testimony.
I will. I will shift to a work session here on the Senate Bill 1158, and we'll be prepared to go right into it as soon as these two folks testify.
I do understand that we're going to session 10.
Yes. I might just going to go ahead while they're getting arranged here and go ahead and vote on this and do the...
Sure.
Okay, I'll move to the floor with a new pass record.
Oh, gotta go to Ways and Means.
Move it to Ways and Means with a recommended due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Duncan has moved Senate Bill 1158 to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion, objection. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Duncan.
Aye.
Senator Smith.
Aye.
Senator Fisher.
Aye.
Senator Steele.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries, we'll see that it gets there. And again, ask your support when it gets there. Go ahead, sir. And,
my name is Dean Wilson. I'm just here to testify on behalf of the Senate Bill 1158 and direct benefit of Portland's Independent Living Center. I'm just going to give you a very brief synopsis. I know we're in the interest of time. We're in a hurry. After spending approximately 5 years collecting Social Security and drinking every day and rarely getting out of bed as a result of my spinal cord injury, I first approached Access Oregon, now Independent Living Resources in Portland, Oregon, after crashing a car into a telephone pole at 80 miles an hour and spending the remainder of that summer in a body cast in 1987. I was given a number at the hospital by a person who told me that these people could help me become more independent. I contacted the Independent Living Center in the winter of 1987. We made an appointment. I went to see an independent living counselor at Independent Living Resources. Up until this time, my parents provided my care, the state paid for my medical needs, and the medical equipment and the federal government was given to me each month to live on. I wanted to work. I wanted to live on my own. I wanted to further my education, but I couldn't even push myself in a wheelchair. And I certainly did not know how to access resources or to how to live independently of my parents or state monies. At this time, I was 24 years old. An independent living counselor worked with me to develop an independent living plan. We mapped out everything I would need to do or learn how to do to become self-sufficient and independent. He assisted me in accessing resources such as vocational rehabilitation. He assisted me in accessing successful individuals with similar disabilities for peer counseling. He provided me with independent living skills training, ranging from how to get around in my environment to advocating for my own rights to services. 3 months after my initial meeting with my independent living counselor, I had accessed and been assessed by the Vocational Rehabilitation Division for assistance. 5 months after that initial meeting, I was a part-time student at Portland Community College. 9 months after that meeting, I was a full-time student and working part-time tutoring other students at Portland Community College. 18 months after that initial meeting, I was preparing to transfer to Portland State University to obtain my Bachelor's of Science degree in Sociology. 2 years after that initial meeting, I was a full-time student at PSU, and I was a full-time working work-study student at the Information Access Center for the Disabled. 3 years after that initial meeting with my independent living counselor, I was 1 year from graduating with my Bachelor's of Science degree and employed part-time at the Independent Living Center in Portland, Oregon. 4.5 years after that initial meeting, I was an independent living counselor. I had received my Bachelor's of Science in Sociology from PSU and was employed full-time at the Independent Living Center in Portland, Oregon. In 4.5 years, I went from being employed on state, unemployed on state assistance or everything, drunk 90% of the time and in bed another 90% of the time, near dead in a car accident, to fully employed off any and all state assistance, paying taxes, contributing to my community, and preparing to pursue my MSW. All of this is in large part a result of the direct services I received from the Independent Living Center. 4.5 years. Instead of being someone who was with an acquired disability who relied on state and others to take care of me, I was working with these persons with disabilities to assist them in becoming self-determined and independent. I had value not only to myself, but also to the community and the state as well. I was productive and contributing. There was only one negative experience I had with an independent living center. The negative experience was I was unable to stay and use my acquired expertise to assist others in becoming self-sufficient and independent. I had expertise, I had a degree, and other people and employers wanted me. I left the Independent Living Center as an employee because they could not afford me, and Portland State University could. This was a painful decision for me, but an easy one. I had to take the higher-paying job with better benefits. I'm currently employed by Oregon Health Sciences University and coordinate 2 federally funded grants, one for the Department of Education and the other for the Administration on Developmental Disabilities. I'm also 7 months away from receiving my MSW from Portland State University while doing an internship at Dornbecker Children's Hospital.
What do you do in your spare time?
Testify in front of committee. I speak locally and nationally on topics as diverse as self-determination and the prevention of brain and spinal cord injuries. I'm a grant reviewer for the Federal Department of Education. I volunteer my time as a member of the Rotary and Lions Club, just don't tell them both, Portland, and I pay an inordinate amount of state and federal tax as well as property tax.
We've heard that one before, Mr. Chair. The way do you support the increase in debt?
Very much so. Chairman Fisher and fellow committee members, I am what DRD calls a successful closer. Vocational rehabilitation gave me the minimal amount of services because of the Independent Living Center's impact on my life. I accessed them for the appropriate amount of services and was out. I urge you to assist others like me with disabilities in allocating funds through the Department of Human Resources throughout Oregon to increase access to independent living centers where other Oregonians throughout the state, thousands of them like me, who do not know of the resources that are available for independent living centers. I appreciate your the opportunity to speak to you, and I would appreciate your support of this bill. Thank you so much, Senator.
Thank you very much. Perhaps we can hold our applause here and try to keep things along as fast as we can. I'm entering a letter from Ellie Jenny into the record, and I know she supports this very much.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just one quick comment. Dean,
yes,
would you total up the amount of money that you were paid at the one end before you got into this and how much you've given back in terms of taxes? I mean, that would be powerful testimony in front of Ray's need.
Certainly, that would become a problem.
What you're doing is essentially saying, yeah, there's a price tag to this, but you're going to get more in your money's worth back if you get people moved from the state of taking through disability, you know, Social Security disability, getting them back to work so that they can pay taxes. That story needs to be told over and over again if you're ever going to hope to get any money out of this Ways and Means.
Certainly.
Also, I'd like to mention that if you haven't noticed already, there are various and different ways that people wind up. The little spark that changes their life and starts them on the road, it doesn't just come from one place. It comes from a variety of places. And something will feel that somebody doesn't make any dent on someone else, but they get it from some other thing. So all of the different facets of this play into how people get a little spark here to change their life. Are you having trouble, Rick, getting the mic?
No, I was just waiting.
Okay, go right ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators. My name is Rick Berger, and I am the president of the Oregon Chapter of American Disabled for Attendant Programs Today, or ADAPT. ADAPT supports Senate Bill 1158. We're an organization that recognizes the importance of independent living services to disabled consumers. Specifically, I would like to relate to you my experience as a consumer of independent living services in two different states. To give you a little background, I have been clean and sober from a substance abuse problem for close to 14 years now. For much of my life, I was not a productive member of society. In 1985, I entered treatment, and as a result, wound up pursuing a career in the security business, at which I was considered fairly good, reached supervisory positions, and in 1991, moved from Portland to the San Francisco Bay Area to take a higher-paying job with a national security firm. However, in 1992, I was forced to stop working due to complications from diabetes. Now, here I was, having spent several years finally being a productive member of society again, and now I was going to have to apply for disability benefits, stop working. You can imagine, you know, the frustration I felt at having to go through this kind of a change. However, much as it pains me to admit that I was living in California, I could not have been in a better place to have gone through this change, because I was living at the time in Berkeley, California, the home of the very first Center for Independent Living in this country. California is a state that provides funding for independent living, unlike Oregon. I was able, at this center, to get involved with peer counselors, and specifically peer counselors who, like me, had become disabled as adults and understood the perspective that I was coming from. I was also provided with benefits counseling as to what I could expect in my attempt to gain Social Security benefits, Medicaid, food stamps, whatever, things I needed in order to survive. The process, I was given an overview of the process. The result was I was not overwhelmed by the process and was successfully able to pursue my claim. The difference is here in Oregon, Passionate and Living in Person, where I do some volunteer work, they do not have the facilities that that center in California has. They do not have a full-time benefits counselor. Many of the peer counselors there do are able to talk to people about benefits. There's nobody who specifically does that. There is a very cramped room to deal with consumers. At the California Center, I was able to use private rooms for talking with my counselor instead of a cubicle. It makes a big difference. I think that independent living resources helps a lot of people. I know it also gives me a lot of advocacy opportunities, which is something that, even though I do not get paid, certainly makes me feel like I'm a productive person. But there is so much more that could be done and should be done.
Rick, while we've still got a committee here, I'm going to quit the workstation and go back into public hearing on Senate Bill 1158 because the police are going to be after us here. The session started at 10 o'clock.
Right.
So I'll go ahead and stay till they come and force me to get out.
I was just wrapping up. Yeah. No, anyway.
But I wanted to finish that
right.
part while I thought there was no question about it. We had it on the record. But
mm-hmm. Well, actually, that will pretty well wrap up what I had to say. I just wanted to give that perspective.
Yeah, I'm sorry to have rushed you folks, but we want to get this on two ways and means, and appreciate you coming. But again, let me reiterate, don't hesitate to get in touch with the people on the Ways and Means Committee. Be there when they work on it. And in the meantime, talk to your own local representatives and senators.
Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1158. I'm going to hold a public hearing on Senate Bill 1290. The witness is ill, but we're going to enter into the record. Will you describe the Senate Bill 1290? Dana?
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 1290 directs all state agencies to assess policies and rules having impact on families using certain considerations. This bill is sponsored by Senator Charles Starr. And his staff, and
with this
bill today. So,
yeah, we can put those off till Wednesday. Okay. I'm close public hearing on Senate Bill 1290 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1027.
It's not really accessible. It's extremely difficult.
Go ahead, Margaret, you're real fast. And then.
Jackson. I want to come back.
All right,
Ann,
go ahead.
Okay, and I'd like to do this. I want to talk to you. But the thing is, I need to make arrangements for accessible. I do not have a bunch of hydrogen and have IOR reviews for my partner. I'll pay the part of it. That's another way to work. I have kids, and that's the whole part.
Sorry to be so rushed this morning, but I guess we'll be that way at least for the next few committee meetings.
Senator Fisher.
Right here.
And members of the committee. I am Ann Jackson. I'm the director of the Oregon Hospice Association, and I'm here on behalf of Senate Bill 1027, which would create an access to hospice care for uninsured Oregonians program. And everything I have to say is in written testimony, and I have also provided the committee with copies of Robert Wood Johnson's product, State Initiatives and End-of-Life Care. Senator Shields has suggested this would be helpful, and it also discusses this bill or something like this on page 5 of it, where it establishes data that indicates that such a bill would be important. There are approximately 300 Oregonians now who fall through the cracks when they're terminally ill and so that they get no care. What this bill would do would be to provide support for them so that maybe they don't have the care they should have throughout their illnesses, but at least they would die with some support of hospice care. We have this bill would also impact many of the rural hospices in the state of Oregon who are very fragile economically. They estimate that it takes about 126 patients per year to make it possible for a closed hospice program to break even. They have one uninsured patient. At that point, they are at risk of going bankrupt. At least they are going to go in the hole. And we have included a map in our testimony indicating which of those hospices are particularly fragile. We have been exceptionally good at making sure that access is available to hospice care for every Oregonian in the state. What that has meant, however, is that we have some very, very small hospices that, and Oregon is the only state that really has emphasized the development of hospices throughout. Because there is only one hospice in each of these communities, if that hospice goes out of business, that means that the community will be without care. Oregon, there is no precedent for this kind of bill. There's never been anything like this established in the country. As usual, Oregon is on the cutting edge. We are recognized as the leader in care at the end of life. And we have done that really very, very efficiently. Very few dollars have really gone into end-of-life care. Most of what has been done has been accomplished based on various groups that have been working for this and as volunteers. We've estimated that to do this bill right, it would cost approximately $1.4 million per year. I think that we could do it for less than half of that. Based on the fact that most of these patients are not likely to be in hospice care for a very long period of time. We've estimated at 45 days because that would be best, but if a patient's length of stay were half that, which is a more realistic figure, then the cost would go down. We've also included a fiscal impact in the materials that we've given you. This is a very big issue. I could go on for a long, long time, and I won't do that.
I noticed the bill is asking, it seemed like you're asking for 1 point. Is that per year?
Yes.
Okay, so it's 2.8 in the
mm-hmm.
bill. Okay.
We've talked to the state health division regarding being a partnership with them. We have established that partnership in cutting costs and making things economical.
Go ahead, Margaret.
Thank you, Senator Speaker. I'm Margaret Carley with Oregon Healthcare Association. We represent nursing homes, assisted living, and residential care facilities, and I actually need to wear three hats today. The first is the Deputy Director of Oregon Healthcare Association and the Legal Counsel, and we support 1027. It's important that people are not suffering and that they have assistance when they're dying. As you know, with the changes in length of stay in the hospital, people die more often in nursing homes, assisted living, and residential care facilities than they do in hospitals, and they also die more often in their homes. So these are clients we see. We see a need to have access to hospice for those clients that are uninsured. My second hat that I need to wear is as a member of the Pain and Symptom Task Force. The Pain and Symptom Task Force supported a recommendation like this, which would ensure improved access. Financial barriers was a big barrier to achieving adequate pain relief. And we want to make sure that we could remove that barrier, at least for those people who are terminally ill and who need hospice care. And the third hat that I'm wearing is I also serve on the task force to improve the care of terminally ill Oregonians, and I have written testimony in support of this bill on behalf of that group. The task force was formed to deal with some of the issues, complex issues that were raised by the Oregon Death with Dignity Act. They put together a variety of resources, including the Final Months to Life, a guide to Oregon resources, and the Oregon Death with Dignity Act, a guidebook for healthcare providers. One of the things that the task force realized is that there are things outside of its scope, and one of those issues includes access to adequate comfort care resources.
and we believe that if we can provide means for obtaining lethal prescriptions, that it's important that we also, as a state, provide access for those who are uninsured to hospice. So the task force strongly endorses the concept of access to hospice care for uninsured clients, and we'd ask for your assistance in supporting this. That will conclude all of my hats, and we look forward to working with the Ways and Means Committee to hopefully bring down the fiscal so that we can get this passed this session.
I'm not sure which of your hats is the most beautiful.
Thank you, Senator Fisher.
Thank you very much. I'm going to go close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1027 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1029. And sorry to rush things through this morning, but deadlines are deadlines. And Elizabeth Gecky and Liz Wilsley Gage. I'm sorry, I'm fouling up the pronunciation. Come right ahead. Is Elizabeth here?
I'm Elizabeth.
Oh, you're Elizabeth. Well, okay.
Elizabeth Gecky. You have a Liz Wilsley George? Oh, okay. Okay.
Okay. All right. Go ahead and we'll just...
I have prepared written testimony, which I will leave for you and try to be very brief in a minute. I am representing a group which are called the Task Force for Legislative Action for Professional Counselors and Therapists. We started 5 years ago as a group of co-workers, and since that time we have expanded weekly to include many more people. We basically started as a group of people who found ourselves unable to become licensed as professional counselors in the state of Oregon. We now include people who are licensed, including in the testimony you will find an article which is currently under publication for professional magazines written by a board member of one of our licensing, one of our professional organizations. She not only supports the bill, she told me yesterday by telephone, but she would also like to add her own amendments to the bill. I don't know what that process would be.
She would need to get with our administrative staff, and we can iron that out and help in that process.
Okay. So this is a result of people who have not been able to become licensed. We have gone to attorneys. We have spent tens of thousands of dollars in attorney's fees and have always received the same instruction, which is go to your legislature. So we have found each other, and we are coming to our legislature. And here we are. We're new at this. We've never done it. We don't have a lobbyist. We don't even have a formal organization. What we chose to do is come collectively and try to speak in one voice and address as many issues as possible. In achieving, when we arrived at these recommendations, it was in coordination with the people who hire us, our employers, who are greatly impacted by the fact that so few of their staff are able to achieve licensing. So in coordination with the people who are hiring us, and in coordination with Senator Gordley's office, who kept asking us to write of our concerns and then took our concerns and put them into legislative suggestions and recommendations, that's what you have in front of you, is 1029.
And I take it then that all of these letters in favor here are kind of extensions of your...
I think most of them will deal with the three amendments. Now we have the new group that Muriel Pastor is representing, and I'm not sure what those letters are going to be saying. That's the group that's asking to support it and add additional amendments.
Okay. I will go ahead and write into the lead into the testimony here in the record. Arinda S. Ross, LPC, is in favor of the.
Someone I don't know.
The bill, Connie Katz, NCC CEAP, Providence Employee Assistance Program, is writing in favor. Maudie M. Cheney, MSNCCC, mental health consultant, is also writing in favor. We have the one with the amendments from Mariel Pastor-Sonenson, MFT, MPS, that is supportive with the amendments. Barbara Werner, MS, mental health consultant, is also writing for it. So I will enter those into the record, and thank you very much for your testimony, and we'll ask John Deal and Carol Fleming.
Thank you, Senator Allard. Appreciate you taking a brief moment, and I'll be succinct, and we'll request a couple of things. One is that I'm the chair of the licensing board, and I'm asking that you look, take into testimony the information that Carol Fleming has given you, and I really wanted to address three particular areas. The first has to do with the amendment that would require that licensees not receive a master's degree, and that the board come up with what would be considered comparable standards. And it's our position at this point that there are not comparable standards to receiving a graduate education. The second issue we wanted to address, which one we weren't sure about, had to do with some of the thinking that went behind this particular amendment. I know that the mental health division has, in Multnomah County, has come out and said through a number of its staff people that they're somewhat supportive of this. And what we're not sure about, whether this particular amendment has to do with an issue of vendorship, or whether it has to do with an issue of competency, or whether it's a matter that there are some individuals who did not receive licensure and are concerned that they can do so by amending the existing regulations. And on that second point, one of the things that we discovered is that people can become a qualified mental health associate provided they work under the guidelines of a qualified mental health practitioner. If there's a financial issue involved, that certainly would meet the Medicaid rules, which were changed in the last several years, that required the providers of mental health services to be master's level folks. So again, we're kind of questioning how much of this is driven by economics and how much of it is driven by the need for having professional standards. So that would be the second issue. And the third issue that I think was particularly of concern to ours is that the amendment reads that if individuals are going to provide mental health services to underserved populations, that they shouldn't have to meet the same educational requirements that currently exist under law. And that really concerns the members on the board, as well as a number of members in the community with whom I've spoken to, including counseling educators. And that is, why would we want to provide services to underrepresented populations by individuals who are less qualified than already exist under the current statutes and Illinois administrative rules? And so that's kind of the third point that we were particularly concerned about. And sort of an allied principle of that, it's like, I suppose if I come forward and say, okay, I have this much education and this much experience, and I'm going to serve underrepresented populations, therefore I deserve to be licensed, does that mean 5 years from now or 3 years from now, if I'm not serving that same population, that I should continue to have my license? So I think one analogy I thought about is that we've seen situations where people who have been legal aides or paralegals have worked in communities serving underrepresented populations, and I think most of us would think it would be pretty ridiculous if those paralegals stepped forward and said, well, we're working with these underserved populations, we've had lots and lots of experience, and we think based on that the Oregon Bar Association should grant us licensure to be practicing attorneys, even though we haven't graduated from law school. And with that, those are the conclusion of my remarks, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak, and if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
over your number two reason here again a little bit here.
The second issue about...
There's several places here. The board's primary concern on the first page and the number two underlined.
Oh, okay. The board believes that it may not, as a state agency, require a standard of education for the same license that people plan to work with other populations. Okay.
It says that this can be done legally. The board knows it has no jurisdiction to make sure the person applying has a degree waiver position will actually serve to continue to serve as designated
population
by you trying to say then that somebody that was working with the state under a different type of situation but still providing the counseling wouldn't necessarily be required, or you would have no control over them.
Correct. I mean, if we license some population. Right. If we license somebody based on their professing of the fact that they are working with an underserved population, we would have no authority at that point once they, if they decided 6 months or even 3 months after the granting of their licensure not to provide services to that population any longer.
Now, my impression of the bill was that it was supposed to help out in reciprocity.
Well, there's a piece of the bill that says that we would recognize licensures from other states or certifications from professional bodies. And at this point in time,
to license out here, not to expedite our people being licensed in other.
Right, exactly. What part of the amendment was is to take people who have moved in from out of state that may have certification.
Well, I mean, even the bill itself.
Right.
I was thinking it was the other way around.
For people coming into the state.
I thought it was to help our people get licensed back elsewhere.
Actually, it would be just the opposite, because right now Oregon, and I recently attended, well, last year I attended a meeting of licensing board professionals, and Oregon is in the top 5% of standards to get licensed, and if this bill were to pass, it would be just the opposite. It would dilute the standards, and people being licensed from Oregon wouldn't have the same credibility they do today.
I'm also going to include a separate letter by Mario Pastor, OMFP, in which she gives about 2.5 pages here of support to this program and indicates the problems she had with the board. You know, we got into a real problem with the Board of Psychologists during the last session, and it was primarily over the manner in which they treated their licensee applicant. And there seems to be a great deal of controversy over some real fine points in this issue, and I know it's come up before in this particular board, problems with knowing for sure what needs to be done.
Senator,
thinking you've accomplished what needs to be done, and then all of a sudden finding out there's a whole bunch more things that you haven't noticed about, and huge expenses, very much difficult, as I recall, trying to get things instituted that, from a minor technical standpoint, here, for instance, where it speaks of a ratio of 1 hour of supervision to 20 hours of experience practice, and then requiring that to be done at the end of every 20 hours. Well, what if your end of your 20 hours comes in a 4-hour session or an 8-hour work day or something like this? Some of those kind of things are just made to get boards into a trap, and I'm not so sure that those are ORSs as much as they are OARs. They're referred to as statutes in here, but I think they're OARs, and
that's correct.
And from that standpoint, boards, I think, need to keep in mind that they should be using a little bit of judgment and flexibility of those things, because they may find that they're running into problems with vast amounts of people They need to remember that a board isn't just a limiting situation that wants to make sure that every one of its members have a good job, paid job. Their job is to make sure that the people are qualified, that they have done a reasonable amount of preparation, and allow the marketplace to sift out the ones that will continue in practice and the ones that won't. Go ahead, Carol.
Oh, I'm Carol Fleming. I'm the administrator for the Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists, and I'm basically here just to support our chair, Mr. Beal, and answer any questions you might have.
Well, Senator Fisher, if you may, I'd like to respond to two of the issues you raised, and I think they're really good ones. The first one is what we established during the last session was an internship program, and we had concerns that people, too, were expected to figure out what they needed to do after the fact. And so what we've done now is we do have this internship program. While it's voluntary, it provides the applicant with an opportunity to say, here's my stuff. You know, here's the academic credentials that I hold, and here's my plan for supervision to become licensed. At that point, we then let them know in an a priori sense about whether that's going to do what they need to do to become licensed. So if there are any problems, they haven't gone through that tremendous amount of time and expense trying to meet that obligation, only to find out that, you know, somehow they missed the mark. So it's our hope is as more and more applicants begin the process, especially those that are graduating from counselor education, marriage family therapy programs, that they'll get into the internship program, and that in essence stands as a contract between the board and the licensee that says now when you accomplish these tasks, you'll then be eligible to sit for the exam. Your second issue, which I'd also like to address, about the ratio of hours to supervision, certainly we have to use a lot of judgment with that. And in the 3 years that I've been with the board, I haven't seen an incident where someone was denied their hours of supervision if they had a ratio that met 1 to 20. Sometimes that's 2 to 40. And every one of us on the board provides training and supervision to our applicants, so we understand meetings get missed and people aren't going to stop a counseling session halfway through and say, gosh, I'm sorry, I'm up to 21 hours now and I haven't gotten my supervision. So what we tend to look at are ratios. And it's, and in practice, I think that we've been quite flexible by looking at, you know, we start getting over 1 over 22, 1 over 23, then it becomes a problem if we see patterns like that. But if somebody shows up with a, you know, it's had 2 hours of supervision over 40 hours of practice, we're going to be okay with that, or 2 hours of supervision with 38 hours of practice. So we do try to look at that ratio. But I appreciate your concerns, and we hear those concerns, and every time we go to rulemaking, we do try to, you know, meet the needs of the consumer, which to a large degree we believe is the public, you know, that we are an advocacy group for licensees per se.
Let's see. Well, I appreciate you coming. I'm going to have a further hearing on this particular issue, and what I would like to direct the board to do would be to bring some type of statistics to us about what would happen to reciprocity in other states, or whether a person that was granted a license if this bill were to pass would just be the only one, or whether it would damage the whole program. And I'd like to be, have that be as pertinent as possible, and not just a supposition.
All right.
I think that would be one thing that we would definitely need to consider, because we do not wish to damage the opportunities of our folks to travel from state to state. And matter of fact, I would personally like to encourage more states to get involved in those kind of things, so it does facilitate people not having delays in their work, and if they need to move or follow a husband or back to take care of their parents or something like this, that they can immediately practice in another state without too much rigmarole. And I would also like to honor the folks that have done that in other states the opportunity to come this way in the same manner. So I would really be very interested in how you present some of that to the committee.
We'd be glad to do that.
Especially, I would say, in at least like California, Washington, and Idaho, at least bordering states.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, we appreciate your time. Thank you.
Close public hearing on Senate Bill 1029, and close the Health and Human Services for the day.
Yes.
I just probably couldn't read correctly.